It's Wednesday, February 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, the road to the White House. We have big winners in New Hampshire. Nigeria feels the pinch of low oil prices.
Basically, this is reflecting the risk-off environment of the global financial market.
Asian markets are rattling investors. Also ahead, Washington ponders reaction to North Korea. The way you watch future sports may already be in your hand. And now you may visit Jimi Hendrix's apartment. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Voters in the northeastern U.S. state of New Hampshire have cast ballots in the first of the state-by-state primaries following the Iowa caucuses last week. The road to the White House is, for the moment, led by two candidates. VOA's Aru Pandey joins us from New Hampshire. Let's start with who won among the Republicans.
Donald Trump, who was in the poll, high up in the polls, and now we see the results coming in that he indeed has been declared the winner. And then we have, on the Democratic side, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, which is not a surprise to anyone. I think everyone was looking at the percentage of points that he would win by, but, you know, he clearly was named the winner very early on after the results came in. So Trump on the Republican side and Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side.
And a boost to both of these campaigns, especially after their showings in Iowa.
Absolutely. I mean, Bernie Sanders was tied in with Clinton in Iowa, so he already did pretty well in Iowa. They were so close. Sweeping this first primary was huge, especially because, you know, New Hampshire has been big for the Clinton family. So she, you know, she didn't just have, you know, this disadvantage because, oh, you know, Sanders is from a neighboring state and so on. I mean, the Clintons have done well here. Bill Clinton has done well here. Hillary Clinton did well here in 2008, but really Sanders did well. And based on talking to voters the last few days, being out and about, you could see it in the people you talk to.
And for Bernie Sanders, this is now a springboard into the next round of primaries where they're going to be heading south. He really has not yet resonated with African-American voters, where Hillary Clinton has a very strong following. And this is something that the Sanders campaign is now looking at.
Absolutely. And you have to look at that. I mean, first of all, you have to look at the number of delegates that New Hampshire has. And then you have to look at the makeup of the voting population. It's primarily white. And so, as you said, going into states like South Carolina, which has a significant African-American makeup, and then to Nevada, where we have a large Hispanic population, a large Hispanic voter population, these two subgroups have been, you know, in Clinton's favor for a while. New Hampshire, like Iowa, is not reflective of the rest of the United States. So it's important for people to remember that. Yes, Sanders did win big here. But when we talk about who lives in both Nevada and South Carolina, we can't discount the minorities and the makeup of how much they make up the Democratic base, 30%.
Now, speaking of South Carolina, on the Republican side, Donald Trump has already spent quite a bit of time there. He's winning big in New Hampshire, and he's hoping now that some of his rivals are going to begin to drop out of the race.
That's right. I mean, he got second place in Iowa and now a big win here in New Hampshire. And so I think everyone's watching to see what happens after this election in order for that Republican race to get smaller. What was interesting here in New Hampshire, Kasich did really well here. I talked to a lot of people out who said, you know what, he's the most moderate. I believe he has a good head on his shoulders. He'll make the right decisions. So he was kind of like the anti-Trump. If I have to vote Republican, I'm going to vote with Kasich. So that was interesting as well. I talked to one woman who said she voted for Bush. She said, you know what, I don't think the Bush name is a problem, and I want someone like him with experience. So like you said, it'll be interesting to see how this race shapes over the next two or three states and who tends to drop out. It's still tough. But we might see people like Christie and Carson reassess, you know, where they are and whether they want to go forward.
With such a crowded bunch of Republican candidates in that second place area, for John Kasich particularly, it was very important because he said basically New Hampshire was his last stop. If he didn't do well, that would be it. Now he's got some life back in his campaign.
Absolutely. Second place so far is not, you know, is not a bad deal. I think that also speaks to the makeup of the New Hampshire voter. They're very independent-minded. But let's see if he can carry that through into the other states as we go forward in this campaign.
We look forward to going further into the campaign and seeing all the different twists and turns with Arup Pandey, who we know you're going to be out there on the trail following it closely for us. Thanks so much for joining us, Arup.
Thanks so much, Jim. I appreciate it.
As always, we're taking the pulse of voters and observers on social media. For that, International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me here in the studio to fill us in on the presidential race, the road to the White House. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. The latest is from The Hill, a Washington-based newspaper. It reported Ben Carson is open to being Donald Trump's vice president. That's a big statement for someone who's still running for the Republican nomination. And of course, there's also the news of former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg considering running for the nation's top office as an independent. But as you know, Bloomberg has been considering for a very long time. So it's not really an exciting news for anyone who has been following domestic politics.
Yes, I read that he said the current race is an insult and an outrage to voters. So what was the Twitter campaign like for the leading candidates Tuesday?
Well, the main message was telling eligible voters to come out and vote. Trump, who is very partial to using all caps in tweets, wrote, "New Hampshire, vote today. Make America great again." Jeb Bush sent out a similar message, and Marco Rubio, for his part, tweeted, "It's official. The FBI confirms it is investigating Hillary Clinton's private server." Now, that tweet got more retweets and likes than any of his other tweets Tuesday.
I see. So no more Bush and Trump savaging each other on Twitter, at least for now.
We move on
to the Democratic Party. What was Hillary Clinton saying?
A lot about her husband, actually. There was a picture of Bill Clinton on the phone with a caption saying, "Checking in to say hi to Hillary on primary day in New Hampshire." Her rival, Bernie Sanders, was getting good feedback from experts. A well-known statistician, Nate Silver, here in the States, said Sanders' odds of winning Tuesday night is above 99%. Also, an economist told CNN that income and jobs will soar under his presidency. That's all for me today. Jim?
Thank you very much, G. You may follow her on Twitter, at G. Abby Lee. I'm on there as well, at VOA Stevenson. And you can follow both of us, as well as the rest of the International Edition team, on our program's account, at VOA _IE. The global fall in the price of oil has rattled the economies of many petroleum producers, and Africa's oil king Nigeria is no exception. As Chris Stein reports from Lagos, analysts are predicting a rough year ahead.
The fortunes of Africa's largest economy have long been intertwined with the price of oil. Crude prices have fallen to $35 per barrel from their peak in 2014, and that has analysts worried. Bismarck Rwane is the chief executive of Lagos-based advisory firm Financial Derivatives Company.
Impact of the fall in oil price is, to put it mildly, catastrophic. In the sense that, in terms of magnitude, huge. In terms of preparedness to deal with the magnitude, totally ill-prepared.
Nigeria produces over 2 million barrels per day, making it Africa's largest producer of crude. About 70% of government revenue comes from crude sales, while the National Bureau of Statistics says petroleum makes up 69% of exports. That reliance on petrodollars puts Nigeria in a vulnerable position when the price plunges, says Ecobank's head of energy research, Dilapo Oni.
Oil is basically the government's main source of revenue for running the economy or running its budget, and that really drives investment into the economy.
President Muhammadu Buhari was elected in 2015 on promises to provide jobs and cut down on corruption. He recently proposed a budget that's about 25% larger than last year and includes numerous investments in infrastructure. But Rwane says the price of oil may force the government to defer some of its promised projects.
If the promises are waiting while the government is spending money on luxuries and ostentation, then there'll be a crisis. But if the government is seen to be austere and frugal, and therefore some of these promises are being deferred until our financial condition improves, then you can get away with that.
The low price of oil may frustrate Mr. Buhari's agenda, but Oni says it could also spur the government to make major changes to the oil industry. These changes include ending the fuel subsidy scheme, which critics have decried as wasteful and corrupt, as well as reforming the state-owned Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. Japan's Nikkei share average posted its biggest drop in nearly 3 years. On Tuesday, it fell more than 5% for its biggest one-day fall in nearly 3 years. The benchmark index has shed 15% of its value so far in 2016. Masamichi Adachi, senior economist of J.P. Morgan in Tokyo, tells VOA's Victor Beatty that investors are driven by fear.
Basically, this is reflecting the risk-off environment of the global financial market. It's not particularly the issue for Japan, but it's more on the global issues.
What are we looking at? A possible global recession? How likely is that?
We think, as economists, probability is still low, but the markets are very concerned on the sort of hard landing of China and the falling energy prices and the blow-up of the emerging economies, private debt. And also, probably people are more concerned on the U.S. productivity or profitability in the corporate of the U.S.
The chairman of the U.S. Central Bank, Janet Yellen, will be testifying before Congress this week. How closely will you be watching her comments?
I think everybody in the world who participates in the financial markets are paying so much attention to what Ms. Yellen will describe the current situation and how the Fed, FRB, will respond to this financial markets rout.
What is causing this rout?
It's basically fear, I think. It's basically fear, as I said. There are basically three tail risks in the global economy or global financial markets. First one is the China hard landing, which we think is very unlikely, but the markets still think that's possible. And also, as I said, emerging economies, they have a huge debt hung up, excess debt, which need deleveraging in the future. So that makes the very fragile situation in the emerging economies. And probably the most important issue is the profitabilities or productivities declining in the U.S.
The yield on Japan's 10-year government bond dropped below zero Tuesday in a first for the G7 country. What's that all about?
Japan has faced very persistent deflation for quite a long time, over the last two decades, and the expectation on the high inflation is very, very low, even the BOJ's aggressive easing. And now, we are describing that the global financial market is definitely sort of searching the next recession, meaning that the deflationary pressure to all over the world. That makes the nominal yield is going down.
Do you expect the entire year to be volatile like it is now?
I don't think that this volatility will continue, for a whole year or something. But probably occasionally that may happen again, I think.
The volatility has benefited the price of gold, which now hovers at about $1,200 an ounce. Well, speaking of volatility, the U.S. Senate is expected to approve tougher sanctions against North Korea as well as its foreign suppliers as early as today. VOA's Michael Bowman joins us as the Senate action comes days after Pyongyang launched a long-range rocket capable of carrying a nuclear payload and weeks after it conducted a nuclear test.
Jim, the Obama administration and the U.S. Congress was already concerned enough after North Korea's most recent nuclear test. North Korea says it was a hydrogen bomb. We still don't really know, and I've asked various senators on the Intelligence Committee if they really know, and they say that it's not clear yet. However, as if Washington weren't concerned enough, there was this launch of a long-range rocket. North Korea says it was to deploy a satellite, but of course everyone is very concerned that a rocket like that could handle some sort of nuclear warhead, and that this is really part of North Korea's long-term nuclear program. We are getting reaction from around the world. Here in the United States, President Obama's National Security Advisor Susan Rice said, we condemn the launch and North Korea's determination to prioritize its missile and nuclear weapons program over the well-being of its people. We will take all steps to defend ourselves and our allies and respond to North Korean provocations. Jim, there is going to be a reaction on Capitol Hill as well. I don't know to what extent what Capitol Hill does will line up with what the White House would like to see done. But last month, a Senate panel, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, passed legislation to tighten sanctions on Pyongyang, but really going after those who help Pyongyang in its military endeavors. So Chinese suppliers, people who help Pyongyang finance its military complex. And in fact, here at VOA, we had the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Republican Bob Corker, in to explain what this was all about. And what he said is, look, what we have are the unintended consequences of doing nothing. It is his belief that the international community has not been forceful enough, that the United States has not taken steps forcefully enough to rein in North Korea and to show Pyongyang that the world means business. And his bill aims to change that.
We have been down this road before. United Nations has, of course, imposed sanctions against North Korea. Certainly there will be more coming out of the UN, whatever that may be. And the U.S. has gone after finances in the past to try to constrict North Korea's ability and, perhaps most importantly, persuade China, its closest ally and direct neighbor, to do something more, take more of an active role. The Chinese have chided us in recent weeks about asking them to do this very thing. And yet here we have this launch. And even the Chinese, at least publicly, have said, hey, we don't like it either.
Indeed. And in speaking with Senator Corker, he compared it to very successful sanctions that were imposed on Tehran for Iran's nuclear program, which were widely credited with bringing Tehran to the negotiating table. There is always this question when there is one country that whose behavior the world is trying to change, but you end up targeting elements or entities of other countries. Mm-hmm. There's a sort of extraterritoriality to the whole thing. And that will ruffle some feathers. And I asked Senator Corker about it, and he said, look, maybe China will be rattled, but maybe we need China to be rattled. Maybe we need China to take a new look at this and to explore the ways in which they can actually influence Pyongyang. But I suspect that whatever is done in Washington, whatever is done at the United Nations, whatever the world community comes together to do, will not be met with silence in Pyongyang.
Well, fortunately, it's never silent when you're in the studio. Thank you so much for joining us, Mike. And we look forward to seeing, indeed, what lawmakers do on Capitol Hill in response to this.
Thank you, Jim.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. An estimated 1 million football fans gathered for a parade and a rally in downtown Denver Tuesday to celebrate the Broncos' 24-10 victory on Sunday in Super Bowl 50 over the Carolina Panthers. That game was huge, of course, for the main television broadcaster CBS and also profitable for its online streaming partner, which offers the future prospects of how all of us could routinely be watching big games. To explain more, we're joined by International Business Times TV reporter Oriana Schwint.
There were all these stories going around how to watch the Super Bowl if you don't have cable. You didn't need cable in the first place. But it is, you know, maybe your antenna isn't great, so you stream. But there were some people who had some issues. It was 1.4 million people on average streaming the Super Bowl. That's a lot of people. That's a lot for the infrastructure of the internet to handle. So there were a few issues, but by and large, pretty successful for CBS. 1.4 million sounds like a lot of people. But then you think, okay, 112 million people watched it just in their homes, and there's 323 million people in the U.S. So we've still got some ways to go. There's room to grow here.
If for some reason you weren't able to watch the game at a home or at a party and you were in transit, you could at least watch it on your phone.
You could, although you would have to have Verizon Wireless to do that, because Verizon Wireless has the exclusive mobile rights. So I think it had to be a screen bigger than 7 inches. I don't want to watch football on my little 4.5-inch iPhone. That kind of defeats the purpose for me. But if you don't have a choice, you gotta get your fix. Verizon Wireless has those mobile rights locked down, so got to find yourself an iPad or something.
It's all about having the rights to these things, and companies pay big money to get the rights to it. That means, I guess, that they're getting some money if they're paying a lot of money.
Oh my, yes. I mean, CBS made estimates from this research firm Kantar Media say about $400 million just for the Super Bowl, and that's just in-game advertising. That's not even all the hoopla surrounding, because you can charge more for advertising there. There's all the sorts of promotional value. It's still a pretty good value for them, even if they pay, $1 billion a year for the rights to these games, which is a lot of money. That's billion with a B.
What are some of the other business advantages to this? I mean, it seems like it's in its infancy right now. Where can it go?
Well, there were a lot of people who were complaining about the stream cutting out or having to refresh or reboot or whatever. But, when you think about it, traditional TV went through those same growing pains. You used to have to, dance around with a coat hanger on your head to find a good signal. And that's not really good user experience. But, the technology advances, and eventually you just turn it on and it works perfectly or as close as you can get. And I think we will head there. I think it'll take a little while, though. You're not going to see the NFL rights for the Sunday games. They're locked in until 2022. So you won't see anything too crazy until then. But once that starts going, maybe in 10 years, you'll see a pretty decent percentage of NFL games offered online without needing a cable subscription.
Oh, the possibilities. Well, we'll have to wait and see which way this will flow, but we've certainly enjoyed our streaming conversation with Oriana Schwint, TV reporter for International Business Times. Oriana, thank you so much for joining us today.
Why, thank you. My pleasure.
Fans of the late Jimi Hendrix will now get to see life as he lived it while in London. International Edition's David Byrd tells us his apartment has been restored and opened as a museum.
Jimi Hendrix and his girlfriend Kathy Etchingham lived in the top floor flat of an 18th century house in London's Mayfair neighborhood in 1968 and 69. Now their former apartment has been faithfully restored to show what life was like for the guitar genius at the height of his career. Persian rugs are on the floor, a Victorian shawl hangs above the bed, and a clamshell ashtray sits on a nightstand. Another room has a wall of album covers, including Hendrix's Are You Experienced, his first album with drummer Mitch Mitchell and bass player Noel Redding. Some of Hendrix's own collection, including a copy of Bob Dylan's Highway 61 Revisited, stained with the guitarist's own blood, are also on display. Dr. Christian Lloyd is a professor at Queen's University and the author of a new book, Hendrix at Home, A Blues Man in Mayfair. He says Hendrix had the advantage of having no neighbors when he rented the flat, so he could make music at high volume if he wanted to.
One of the great advantages of living here was that there were no neighbors. It wasn't really a residential street at that time. So you could play music as loud as you liked, and they did. I think it was a kind of place where, after they'd been to the speakeasy, so one of the music clubs, just 5 or 10 minutes walk away, they'd come back here later and hang out and so on. So, yeah, Jimmy was 25 when he was here, so yeah, they had some fun, yeah.
The display also features Jimi Hendrix's acoustic guitar, an Epiphone FT-79, which was always within arm's reach.
That guitar was always leaned up against the bed there. It was always within hand's reach. He composed many of his most famous songs on that guitar, not on an electric guitar, actually. And she said, you know, he'd play and play and play. You know, people think of Hendrix as a genius. He was also someone who worked really, really hard on his music.
The apartment at 23 Brook Street is next to the former house of composer George Friedrich Handel. It was originally office space for the Handel House Museum, but so many people visited Hendrix's old apartment that a temporary exhibition was mounted 5 years ago. That was such a success that museum directors decided to open a permanent exhibition in the flat. Barry Wenzel is a former photographer for Melody Maker magazine who photographed Jimi Hendrix in the flat in the 1960s. Some of his images are on display in the exhibit. He says he thinks that Jimmy would be pleased.
Every time I hear that, Hey Joe on the radio, I'm back in the darkroom again. The music and the pictures are on mnemonic to bring you back into that, and I think it's very important for the younger generation who don't know that world of freedom and hippiness and money wasn't an issue, and hey, you walk down the street and there's Jimmy Page or Richie Blackmore, or you go to the speakeasy and there's Keith Moon destroying somebody's drum and drinking somebody to the floor in the bar.
The Jimi Hendrix House Museum opens to the public February 10th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Hey Joe, where you going with that gun of yours?
No doubt Joe has been listening to International Edition with the rest of us. You can find us at voanews.com, on Facebook at VOA_IE. For Director Tracy Carter and Engineer Chaz Hall, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Speaking in Kigali, Rwanda, U.S. Secretary of Commerce Penny Pritzker, at the beginning of her visit to that country late January, discussed the commitment of the United States towards strengthening economic trade with the East African community. Secretary Pritzker said, "Today I am joined in Kigali by the group of senior executives who comprise the President's Advisory Council on Doing Business in Africa. Their charge is to provide recommendations to President Obama and me on policy steps we can take to strengthen commercial engagement between the United States and countries across Africa, including how to build lasting partnerships between the U.S. and African private sectors. Rwanda and the East African community have a lot to offer U.S. investors," said Secretary Pritzker. "East Africa is the most integrated and fastest-growing regional economic community in Africa. The PACDBIA members, as representatives of the American business community, have had the opportunity to share their perspectives on policies that can foster deeper economic trade ties between the East African community and the United States. As part of this visit, our delegation met with President Kagame for a roundtable discussion on the opportunities presented by regional integration. While we continue to deepen our commercial relationships, our delegation arrived at a challenging moment," said Secretary Pritzker. "The United States has expressed its disappointment that President Kagame has chosen to run for a third term in 2017. We believe that respecting established term limits can strengthen democratic institutions and help build a vibrant and free society. The relationship between the United States and Rwanda is deep and mature," said Secretary Pritzker. "The depth of our relationship does not mean we never have disagreements," the secretary noted. "Rather, the depth of our relationship means that we discuss disagreements openly and candidly, and we work together to address them."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage. www.voanews.com/editorials.